From NPR and WBUR, I'm Peter O'Dowd.
I'm Tanya Mosley. It's Here and Now. The Department of Homeland Security announced just this morning new regulations for detaining migrant families that cross the U.S.-Mexico border illegally. Under the new rules, migrant families could be held indefinitely. This alters protections put into place more than two decades ago by the Flores Settlement Agreement. Joining us now is NPR correspondent Richard Gonzalez. Hi, Richard.
Good morning.
Well, let's listen to Acting Homeland Security Chief Kevin McAleenan announcing the change this morning.
The new rule establishes a high national standard for care of children and families in custody, allows the government to keep families together for fair and expeditious immigration proceedings, restores integrity to our immigration system, and eliminates the incentive for children to be used or exploited to enter the United States.
Richard, this new regulation calls for migrant families to be held together, but for how long is now changing? Tell us more about this new rule change.
Well, what's really different about this change is that migrant children will be held indefinitely along with their parents. Under this Flores settlement, it's also known as the Flores Agreement, children could not be held for more than 20 days, or at least that was the general understanding. And the Flores settlement grew out of a court case dating back to 1997, which immigration advocates had filed on behalf of a young girl named Jenny Flores. The conditions under which she was detained way back then were substandard, and they did not meet minimum child welfare standards. That case was headed to the Supreme Court when the government and immigration advocates settled, and they came up with guidelines on how the government should treat children. So the bottom line is that children should not be detained for more than 20 days or 3 weeks, and they should be reunited with their relatives who are in the U.S. under the settlement. That is what the administration is trying to change.
That's what they're trying to change. A big question that people have is, will this these changes keep families together? Will this end child separation?
Well, on the face of it, it could end family separations because there would be no need to separate families if they're held together indefinitely. And that's basically the administration's argument. But the administration has been flying by the seat of its pants. You know, few people ever imagined that they would separate families to begin with. So it's easy to imagine that there could be another justification for family separation. And one that's used right now is when border officials find that a parent has some kind of criminal record, either real or contrived, and they use that as a basis for separating the families, even though a federal judge has said you shouldn't be doing it any longer.
Okay, another thing is this previous Flores Agreement dictated that the program must provide physical care, food, clothing, medical, and dental care for children. But we learned that these detention centers have failed to provide these basic services. Did they talk at all today about how this new regulation addresses those problems?
Yes, you know, the Secretary of Homeland Security, you know, is trying to undercut the criticism from the past, and he talked about a campus-like setting and that there would be medical, educational services, and that there would be indoor and outdoor entertainment, legal counsel, translation services, et cetera, including immunizations. But this remains to be seen. We haven't seen conditions like this held to such standards until now. Perhaps the administration is saying, we will have to do it now if we're going to get rid of the settlement.
It's probably likely that this new regulation will be challenged in court. Have you already heard mumblings of that?
You can take that to the bank. It will be challenged. The Flores settlement is considered considered sacrosanct by immigration advocates. They have relied on it to force the government to meet minimum child welfare standards, as I've said before, and they will use every effort to fight the administration on this.
How soon will we see these new regulations go into effect?
According to the administration, they hope to implement this within 60 days, and that will give, between now and then, you will see a legal battle.
Richard Gonzalez is NPR national correspondent. Thank you so much, Richard, for your time.
It's my pleasure.
In India today, Prime Minister Narendra Modi is praising the landmark journey of India's second lunar mission, which entered the moon's orbit Tuesday almost 1 month after it blasted off. Chandrayaan-2 is set to become the first spacecraft to land near the moon's south pole on September 7th. A successful mission would be a big prize for the country's emerging space program. Joining us now from Bangalore is Pallav Bagla, science editor for New Delhi Television and a correspondent for Science Magazine. Pallav, welcome.
Thanks a lot. A pleasure joining you.
Glad to have you. And the chairman of the Indian Space Research Organization, which is the equivalent of NASA in this country, told reporters that our hearts almost stopped yesterday when the spacecraft entered lunar orbit. This is no easy feat to pull off. How are scientists feeling?
Oh, I was there in the Indian Space Research Organization when they made these announcements, and they are in a celebratory and a jubilatory mood. Simply because if they had missed it, it was mission failure for them. So yesterday's maneuver was a make or break effort, and they accomplished it with flourish. So they had reason to be in celebratory and jovial mood.
Now, they still have to land this thing on the lunar surface. And what will it do when it gets there, if it gets there? What's the scientific purpose of the trip?
See, Chandrayaan-2 is really a carry forward of India's maiden mission to the moon, Chandrayaan-1, which was done in 2008. Chandrayaan-1 made the startling discovery of the presence of water molecules on the moon, and it changed the lunar geology and the understanding of the moon's surface. Chandrayaan-2 carries a suite of experiments. Most of them are Indian. There is one piggybacking American instrument from NASA. The orbiter carries instruments which will sniff the thin atmosphere of the moon. For the first time, a dual band radar is being carried on the orbiter, which will search for the presence of water and water ice on the moon. The lander carries instruments which will measure what would be the equivalent of earthquakes, what are called moonquakes. But more importantly, Chandrayaan-2, if it lands successfully on the moon surface, will place India's flag once and for all intact on the lunar surface.
Well, right. In fact, if this mission is a success, India will become only the fourth nation to make a soft landing on the moon. Of course, there's the United States, the former Soviet Union, and China, now possibly India. How much of a point of pride is this for your country, and how does the Indian Space Research Organization stack up against other agencies around the globe?
Well, it is a matter of great pride. It's the second attempt where India's satellite has been successfully captured by the moon, and if the soft landing on the moon, which is likely to happen very close to the south pole of the moon, happens, then India would become the first country to reach as close to the south pole as possible. And the world is looking to go to the south pole of the moon for setting up a habitation at some point or the other. It is a matter of great pride for the country. And the Prime Minister of India, Narendra Modi, is really leading the charge in trying to ensure that India's space agency delivers on it. And the Indian Space Agency is working hard to make the dreams of 1.3 billion Indians fulfilled by successfully completing this Chandrayaan-2 mission. And they wanted to go to a new area because they say if you go to a new area, doing good science and coming up with discoveries is much higher than revisiting the equatorial region where 12 Americans have walked around and kicked around. So they needed to go to a new area, and they identified going to the south pole of the moon, which is also the area of current interest. Because when President Donald Trump has announced return to the moon, this is also likely to happen near the south pole of the moon, because that is where people expect copious amounts of water to be available.
This is not a manned mission. I know India does have plans to put people in space. What's next for India's space program?
Well, certainly, India has plans to put humans in space, and India doesn't call its program a manned mission because India expects that women would be equally part of this mission. So it's called the Human Space Flight Program.
Fair enough.
First flight for carrying Indian astronauts into space on Indian rockets from Indian soil, from India's spaceport Sriharikota, which is on the coast of the Bay of Bengal, is likely to happen sometime in 2022, which is the 75th year of India's independence. And the Indian Space Agency is working against a very stiff deadline to meet this very big challenge which India's Prime Minister has thrown towards the Indian Space Agency.
There always is a bit of national pride whenever countries are talking about going into space, and that is the case for India as well. That's Pallav Bagla, science editor for New Delhi Television and a correspondent for Science Magazine. Thanks very much. Interesting stuff.
Thank you very much. Pleasure talking to you.
And you can bet we'll be hearing more on this story September 7th when the spacecraft is scheduled to land near the South Pole of the Moon. That is a Saturday.
The yield curve has inverted. In the past, this has been an indicator that a recession is on its way. But will this time be different? Listen to The Indicator from Planet Money, NPR's daily economics podcast, to find out.
What if the most radical thing we can do is to simply be well? That's the thesis of Casey Gerald's new essay, The Black Art of Escape, published by New York Magazine this month. And it's resonating. Casey has been bombarded with a steady stream of letters and messages from people throughout the world moved by this idea. This isn't Gerald's first work. He's also the author of an autobiography called There Will Be No Miracles Here and founded MBAs Across America, where he and other MBAs travel the country matching students with small businesses. I had a chance to have him on my podcast, Truth Be Told, back in May. Casey, it's so nice to be with you again.
I'm so happy to be with you again, Tanya.
So you open up your essay talking about a period of your life 3 summers ago when you decided to disappear. Like, you literally downloaded a manual called The Vanishing Point, How to Disappear in America. Talk a little bit about what was going on in your life during that time.
Well, in a lot of ways, I had reached a dead end. And I had accomplished about everything there was to accomplish for a young person in this country. I had gone from a, you know, young, poor, black, queer, damn near orphan in Oak Cliff, Texas, had gone on to Yale and Harvard and Wall Street and Washington and given TED Talks, blah, 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 blah. But I was very cracked up. And it was a time when, for black people in this country, 2014, 2015, 2016, it was almost a psychic shattering that had happened for so many of us. And I just couldn't go any further. So I said, I'm going to close my organization. I'm going to quit my job. I'm going to leave New York, and I'm going to go into hiding. Now, at that time, I thought it was just kind of a weird disappearing act, and nobody understood it. But what I found and what I write about in The Black Art of Escape is that I actually was joining a long tradition of flight embodied in the black and African-American and African diasporic tradition and told so beautifully by Toni Morrison in her Song of Solomon and Guitar Tales' Milkman Dead, Wanna Fly? Got to let go of all that stuff that weighs you down. And that, I think, looking back, is what I did in 2016.
Let's talk a little bit about our ancestors and how you use that as a point of reference to where we are today and maybe looking to our future. You write in your essay that you don't believe that we are our ancestors' greatest dreams, because that's something that I've lived my entire life thinking and believing, and many great writers have written that. But instead that they are our greatest hope. And what do you mean by that when you talk about them being our hope? Because hope is often a look to the future, and they're our past.
Well, it goes to the heart of why I wrote this. I wanted, first of all, to write it for black people. And I wanted us to mark and honor the 400th anniversary of the first enslaved Africans who were brought to this land in 1619, those 20-some-odd Negroes that arrived in Point Comfort, Virginia. I wanted us to say thank you to all of our people who came after, who paid such an enormous price for us to be here, for a black, free black man and a free black woman to be on NPR, you see. And also to try to answer the question that we've been trying to answer in all this time. How can we live in a land that's made to kill us? Now, we've been told a great deal about our people's strategies of resistance and protest. We've been told about their strategies of assimilation and respectability. What we've not been told enough about, again, is our people's tradition of flight. And there was this great story all over the diaspora of Africans who knew how to fly, and they came here through the Middle Passage, and some forgot, but some remembered, and one day they'd be out in the field, and they'd say a secret word, Kum Baba Yali, and black men and black women and black children would get up on wings and they'd fly away. Now, did this actually happen? Who knows? But what it actually is important to understand is what purpose this served for the people. And what I believe in terms of where we go from here, regardless of the external conditions and external reality of white supremacy, white nationalist terrorism, Trump, or anybody else, we have an inner resource of freedom that is our birthright and our inheritance that we have to reclaim and renew and restore and harness. And that is what I've tried to do with this essay and with my own life.
You say there are three strategies to make it in this world as a black American. The John Henry way, you work hard and you'll succeed. The Nat Turner way, resist. And then there is this third strategy, which you're talking about right now. Can you delve a little bit deeper into that?
Mm-hmm. Well, my therapist says everything and everybody you encounter either nourishes you or depletes you. So I try first and foremost to get every source of depletion out of my life. The easiest, lowest hanging fruit there is cutting off the news, except for NPR, of course, here and now. But I cut off the news. I cut off empty, toxic chatter. I try to leave environments. This is why I left New York at that time. It wasn't so much New York. It was the life that I was living in New York. So some of that is just getting rid of the depletion. And then you say, okay, well, how do I nourish myself? I try to sleep. I try to eat well. I go to therapy, and I go to somatic therapy, which is all about the embodied healing, because it's not just about the conscious mind. I do meditate. I do spend time in isolation. I have not dropped acid, though, of course, if it gets to that point, I'll consider it. But I try to surround myself with other people who are ruthlessly committed to nourishing their inner freedom, and we learn from each other. And that's what's been so beautiful about the Black Art of Escape. It has not been me standing on the mountaintop telling black people anything. It's been a beautiful communal conversation about what this means for and with each other.
This at the same time, though, for some might feel like, or they might say, it sounds like a luxury to say during this time in history that instead of living in resistance, that you're focused on what you call renewal in taking naps. I love to take naps, by the way. I do. Like, my mom will say, are you going to take a nap? You know it.
I
mean, the idea that taking a nap at this time, when we talk so much about being woke, is actually maybe turning our back on what is needed at this time. What do you say to that?
Well, first of all, if you want to be woke, you got to be well over the long haul. There's no enlightened being in the history of the world who doesn't say that the inner self being free is a primary condition for the outer world experiencing freedom. So that's one. Aside from that, as I say, nothing that I'm saying absolves us of our responsibility to be citizens. But white people get to be citizens as a hobby. Black people are expected to make citizenship their full-time job, plus overtime.
Explain what you mean by that.
Well, I'll tell you, I have great friends who have devoted their lives to fighting injustice and white supremacy and police brutality, among other things, and I love and respect them for it. But I would love and respect them even if they didn't. I don't believe that black freedom ought to require black death. I think of the great military general George Patton, who said, no man ever won a war by dying for his country. The point is to make the other poor dumb bastard die for his country. So I want black people to live. I don't want them dying for some cause or for some country that's not going to lift a finger for them. Of course, we have spent 400 years doing just that. And I respect and admire and honor all those people who did. But I think it's due time for us to realize that to some degree, black people fighting white supremacy is a bit like Don Quixote tilting at windmills.
Hmm. I also want to talk to you about something that you accidentally witnessed a few years ago, the reenactment of Miss Fannie Moore. Can you tell us a little bit about that?
Oh, this story. Oh, it changed It changed my life, and I think anybody who hears it will never forget it. And I learned of the story of Miss Fannie Moore through a brilliant black artist, Jatavia Gary, and her work, An Ecstatic Experience. In the 1940s, the Federal Writers Project went down to Georgia and spoke to a woman, Miss Fannie Moore, who told them about her mother. One day on the plantation, Miss Fannie Moore's mother got happy. She started singing and shouting and hooting and hollering. And the old Master Jim, he comes down and he says, "What's all this going on in the field? You think I sent you out here to hoot and yell? No, sirree, I sent you out here to work, and you better work before I put this cowhide across your black back." And a smile comes across Miss Fannie Moore's mother's face, and she says, "Lord has shown me the way. I ain't gonna grieve no more. No matter how you all treat me and my children, the Lord has shown me the way, and someday we ain't gonna be slaves no more." No, Mess Jim takes that bullwhip and starts lashing Miss Fannie Moore's mother's back, but she didn't say nothing. She just went on back out into the field, shouting and singing, "I'm free. I'm free. I'm free." So I wrote The Black Art of Escape, and I'm going around having conversations with black people about it because I want my 14-year-old niece, I want my 7-year-old cousin, I want those two little black boys I saw on the A train going uptown in New York City yesterday to know that no matter how this society treats them, there is an inner freedom that the world didn't give them and the world can't take away.
Casey Gerald, the author of The Black Art of Escape in New York Magazine. Thank you, Casey.
Thank you so much.
And we want to hear from you. What are some ways you escape? Join the conversation at hereandnow.org. President Trump said today that he now considers the door open to new background checks for gun purchases. But here's what he said yesterday to reporters.
"We have very, very strong background checks right now, but we have sort of missing areas and areas that don't complete the whole circle."
This comes less than a month after mass shootings in El Paso and Dayton, and news that the president talked with the NRA just yesterday when he seemed to backtrack on an earlier promise to work towards background checks. I spoke with Politico's Anita Kumar earlier today and asked her about the reaction to the back and forth on background checks.
"Well, everyone is just trying to figure out what's going on, and there's just lots of conflicting information. On the one hand, the president has directed his staff to continue meeting with groups, with congressional aides, to try to come up with some kind of plan for him for when Congress comes back in a couple weeks. But on the other hand, we hear that he has made a deal with the NRA chief, Wayne LaPierre, just yesterday that they won't look at background checks at all." And so it's sort of a conflicting situation. We don't know exactly what he will agree to or what he will look at.
Do you have more details on that conversation between the NRA and President Trump?
Sure. President Trump and Wayne LaPierre talked. Now, they've talked several times over the last couple weeks since those two shootings in Texas and Ohio. But they did have a lengthy conversation yesterday in which they went over sort of the more specific policies. Some of the other things that they're talking about looking at are red flag bills, which what that is it allows someone, a judge, to take away a firearm from someone if they're deemed, a danger to themselves or to others, so they could temporarily get the firearm removed. And then he's also looking at other things that don't have to do with guns per se, like video games and mental health and funding of mental health. The White House really pushed back, though, yesterday when I talked to them and said, look, the president has talked about, quote, meaningful background checks. So that's not saying he's opposed to background checks, but what we're hearing is that he has taken off the table this bill in Congress that's sort of the universal background check. So that means if someone is buying a gun at a commercial place, a gun show or somewhere else, they would have to go through a background check. That the NRA has opposed that for years.
President Trump yesterday also doubled down to reporters in the Oval Office on the connection between gun violence and mental health, as you mentioned. Has he said anything about what he plans to do around mental health and mental health services?
No, we haven't heard any specifics on that beyond putting more money into mental health programs. That's something that has been talked about for quite some time. But the issue of mental health is sort of a talking point from the NRA. And, you know, it's not about the firearm. It's the person who's shooting the gun, they say. And so there's a lot of back and forth about that. The only thing we've heard so far is funding. Important to note that President Trump did get a briefing yesterday from his staff, who has been looking at this for the last couple weeks. They've been looking at all sorts of issues after the two shootings a couple weeks ago. And it's after that briefing that we expect him to sort of make a decision and get behind some of these proposals.
Anita Kumar is White House correspondent and associate editor at Politico. Anita, thank you.
Sure, thank you.
Terrible story we're following out of Detroit. A 9-year-old girl died this week when 3 dogs attacked her in an alley behind her house. Neighbor Edward Cruz told Fox 2 Detroit News that he tried to get the animals off the girl.
I ran towards them and I grabbed a brick, threw it at them. They all ran out. I don't know where they went. So I decided to stay with the girl to make sure that she's okay. I yelled out for help.
Police say the owner of the 3 pit bulls was arrested, and it is a reminder that dog attacks do happen, and although rare, they can be fatal. Let's bring in Margie Alonzo. She's director of the International Association of Animal Behavior Consultants. Margie, welcome.
Hi, thank you.
And when you hear that story about that poor little girl in Detroit, as a person who understands animal behavior, what are you thinking?
I mean, the first thing I'm thinking is how horrible. I mean, there's nothing that any of us could feel but absolute horror at this. And then the next place I go to is that this is a human animal problem, even more than a canine animal problem. Attacks tend to happen more on children and on older people. Mm-hmm. And dogs, often when there is going to be some sort of an attack, it happens with a group of dogs. We had a situation like that here and recently with some 14-year-old boy also perished.
Here in Massachusetts.
Yeah. The first thing I think is that these are uncontrolled, well cared for dogs, and that's what leads to this.
And we'll get to that. But first, let's dig into some of the things you've said. Number one, more likely to happen with a child or an elderly person. Why is that?
I don't know that there's data on exactly why, but I can certainly say that with children, a lot of bites occur often because there's running, squealing, different movement.
Mm-hmm. This little girl was on a bike.
Right. And so dogs chase. That's one of the things that they are hardwired to do. And so that can certainly trigger some of this. I don't think it's fair to blame her for biking.
No, of course not.
But we have to look at the situation as a whole if we want to try to stop further events like this.
What is going on in a dog's brain when it decides to attack? I've heard it described as something like a red zone.
That's not a thing.
No.
But it's a very good TV thing. What we can observe is that dogs that are highly aroused in terms of excitation, in terms of a prey drive, in terms of protection, will then kind of ramp up. And the switch just flips. And that's when dogs are really dangerous, especially in groups. Dogs are not pack animals. We commonly call them packs of dogs, but that's, again, a sort of TV falsehood.
Really?
Dogs are, you know, they're scavengers. They mm-hmm. live in loose social groups. They come and go. 30% of the world's dogs are owned or a breed.
So then why do you say they're more likely to do an attack in a group of dogs?
They do get super excited when there's more than one. They feed off of each other's excitation. I don't know if you've ever been to a concert and you see large groups of people lose their minds. Mm-hmm. And that happens with dogs too.
There's a group called dogsbite.org that tracks these statistics. It says that 35 dog breeds contributed to 433 deaths in a recent 13-year period. So it is rare, but it's not insignificant.
Right.
And people will hear this story from Detroit and they'll be tempted to blame the breed.
Yeah.
Others will be quick to defend the pit bulls
right.
and blame the owner for not keeping them under control. But tell me first what you can tell us about how aggressive one breed is over another.
That isn't a thing either. Certainly there are some breeds that are born and bred for protection. And those dogs that are in protection lines might be more easily inclined to bite. But there's also sort of a cachet. If I own a certain breed and I am a certain kind of person, I want, you know, this to be either protective or threatening. I don't know if this is still true, but I know that several years ago I read a study that golden retrievers were responsible for more bites on children than any other breed. And that's, you know, we could then easily say, well, golden retrievers are dangerous. And that's not true.
People get really defensive about this. People who
yeah.
like pit bulls say,
yeah.
you know, back off. They're fine animals. They're beautiful animals. And you say golden retrievers can be dangerous too. That's the most iconic, American pet, you know, around.
But
right?
that's the point, right? So we think they're good with children because that's how they're advertised by breeders and mm-hmm. breed clubs. And then they tend to be around more children. And so there are more bites to kids from goldens than from pit bulls per this study. Doesn't mean they're dangerous.
So what should a person do when you're walking down the street, you turn around and all of a sudden a dog is charging at you?
The first thing we should do is remember this is a neighborhood issue. This is a community issue. Get to know your neighbors if you can. Talk to delivery people. See if there are places that they know that there are problematic dogs. Your animal control officer is your friend. And then we should avoid things if we can, even if it's not fair. If you can't walk by that house because this dog is always barking and it bugs you, don't walk by that house. So first there's preventive stuff. Then if you've got a dog charging at you, the first thing we have to do is define that. There are people who are terrified of dogs, and if the friendliest dog in the world ran at them and jumped on them, they would absolutely consider that an attack.
Right.
It's not by any sort of objective measure. So let's say that what you're saying is if you are in danger, the first piece of advice people get is usually be a tree, right? Stand still,
mm-hmm.
don't move, don't flail. And that often works. But it only works if you're a certain kind of person that can do that.
Well, let me tell you, this happened to me. A couple of years ago, I was walking my Chihuahua down the street, and all of a sudden, I see a dog jump over a fence and start sprinting at us. I mean, my heart started beating a million miles per hour. My first instinct was to run, but what I did was I turned around, I faced the dog, and I actually started walking towards it in a sort of big way, and it stopped in its tracks. And it turned around. It worked for me, but I don't know if I did the right thing.
Well, you clearly did the right thing because it stopped. If you can stand still, if you don't have another, like a little dog, if you are able to and you're not so terrified that you're going to start screaming, standing still, looking down, breaking eye contact is a good idea.
Mm-hmm.
What you did is another good idea, which is that you sort of say,
I'm in charge.
I don't know if it's in charge, but I think that if we can sort of remove a lot of the human constructs around this, it's sort of saying, I'm not giving you anything to chase and I'm a little bit threatening to your advances.
Mm-hmm.
That dog, I would argue, was not going to kill anyone. But that doesn't mean he wasn't being a jerk. And
right.
it doesn't mean it was okay.
Yeah, I feel like I got lucky, right?
Yeah.
Now, what if the dog didn't turn around and
yeah.
you are beset by a dog and it's biting you and it is actively attacking you? How do you
yeah.
stop it?
This gets a little graphic. I mean, what you need to do to stop it is anything you can do to stay alive or keep your pet alive. If you have a wallet and you can't, shove it down its throat. If you poke its eyes, you can. If you can shove a stick or anything that you have in its jaws and set it back in the animal's mouth, the front, they'll just snap it. If you can shove it way mm-hmm. back, it can help. If you are worried about it on an ongoing basis, you can carry a can of what's called Direct Stop or other citronella-based sprays mm-hmm. That you can spray in the animal's eyes. I mean, at that point, it's about stay alive and keep your child or pet alive. Don't worry about the other dog, even though that's very hard.
Look, I'm trying not to sound alarmist here. This happens to people. So, it happened recently to a friend of mine. Most of them don't end up
no.
in a tragedy. It's just a scary experience. Yeah. And that's what I want to ask you about next. Everyone has a dog story. Mm-hmm. You know someone who's terrified of dogs because something happened to them once when they were a kid. Mm-hmm. Why do those experiences stay with us for so long?
I have two thoughts on this. One is that I think there's something visceral about animals. We are so removed from the natural world at this point that I think sometimes there's something that harkens back to, our days in the trees, that where it gets really scary. But also, I'm not sure it's different than when I was, hit by a car on my bike when I was a kid. I think those things stay with us. The problem is that when there's another sentient being involved and it's not our species, it becomes a little bit mythical in our consciousness. And the way to handle that, exposure in a safe way can really sort of help the person that's afraid learn whether this is really something they don't want or if it's something they do want and their fear is just keeping them from it. There's a lot of therapy dog organizations where you can reach out and say, I would like some limited exposure. You don't have to touch the dog. You can be a football field away. Or you can sort of help yourself to see whether this is actually a phobia you have or if you just haven't sort of gotten past that threshold.
Margie Alonzo is director of the International Association of Animal Behavior Consultants. Margie, thanks for your time. Nice to speak with you.
Thank you very much for having me.
And Margie has some helpful ideas what you can do in case you're face-to-face with an aggressive dog. It's at hereandnow.org.
Draining plastic. That's the unsettling title of a recent study from the U.S. Geological Survey. The research found tiny plastic particles in a rainbow of colors like hot pink and purple in 90% of rainwater samples collected along Colorado's Front Range. That includes a remote site in the mountains. Colorado Public Radio's Michael Elizabeth Sackis reports.
At a community garden in Arvada, Colorado, plots are in full bloom with flowers, fruits, and veggies. And it's hot, not a cloud in the sky. But what Gregory Weatherby wants is rain.
We've been taking samples here off and on and doing different kinds of studies here off and on for well over 20 years.
Weatherby stands next to a machine that collects rain in a bucket. Each week, the samples are filtered and tested. Weatherby's project was about nitrogen pollution.
Not about microplastics. It was the furthest thing from my mind when we first started this project.
Weatherby calls his discovery serendipitous. Usually he sends the rainwater filters off to a lab, but one day he decided to try something different.
I thought maybe I should look at these under a microscope. And when I did, I was a little shocked by the amount of plastic that I saw in them. Chunks of blue, orange, pink. You name it.
These plastics are invisible to the naked eye, tiny pieces of mostly fiber material. This community garden is close to traffic, parking lots, homes, and stores. There's a lot of plastic around. So what really surprised Weatherby was when he saw microplastic in the rainwater collected at a site 10,000 feet above sea level in Rocky Mountain National Park.
Which requires a 3.5 mile hike on snowshoes or skis to get into. That made me realize that what we had here was something that was quite significant because the question is, how do those plastics get into that remote area?
Weatherby's study doesn't answer that big question, and he doesn't want to speculate, but it makes him think that somehow plastic is transported through the atmosphere. His findings are the first in the U.S., but a similar study out of France this year echoes his results. In a remote part of the Pyrenees Mountains, researchers found microplastics in the rainfall. The lead author told the National Geographic that, quote, microplastic is a new atmospheric pollutant. Weatherby says the plastic could be coming from all sorts of sources, synthetic fibers from our clothing, shreds from tires on the roads. When a bag or bottle breaks down, it becomes tiny pieces that spread.
Now I can't get out of the car at the supermarket without noticing all the plastic trash on the ground.
Plastic is being found everywhere, in the deep ocean, in the stomachs of whales, in the fish that we eat, and in the water we drink. A study by Orb Media found that 94% of tap water samples collected in the United States contained micro and nanoplastics. Alice Fulmer is with the Denver-based Water Research Foundation. She says that plastic in rainwater is just one example of the challenges around treating for these tiny man-made materials.
It's just that there's such an abundance that even removal of most of them can result in some getting through.
Fulmer says research on microplastics is relatively new and hasn't established whether these particles are actually causing harm to people and the environment.
And I think that's why we really need to conduct more research on them, how to treat them if, in fact, they are deemed to be a concern for human health and the environment.
The Water Research Foundation is involved in a project that's looking at ways to remove microplastics from water. But Fulmer is also focused on the big picture.
We've got to then be having those conversations as a society and think holistically about how to prevent them from entering the environment and limiting exposure.
An assistant professor at the University of Denver has some ideas for that. Jack Buffington teaches supply chain management and just released a book called Peak Plastic: The Rise or Fall of Our Synthetic World. Buffington argues it's the supply chain that's created the problem.
We can create these materials at such a cheap price. We can throw them away. We can produce them all over the world. We can ship them all over the world.
He says these plastics weren't designed to be in a circular system, like aluminum cans are, for example. It's easier and more economical to recycle aluminum products than to dig up materials and make them new. And aluminum doesn't downgrade in the process. Buffington says plastics need to be designed the same way.
Problem is that how long is it going to take for that to happen?
Buffington says the first step in addressing the issue is getting people to understand the scope of the problem, like just how pervasive plastic is in our environment. Gregory Weatherby, the researcher with the USGS, wants to get out the same message. That's why he's titled his paper, It's Raining Plastic.
It's an emphatic statement about a condition that we believe is something that people should know about.
That there's more plastic in the environment than what meets the eye. For Here and Now, I'm Michael Elizabeth Zakis.
And we close this hour with a note about wildfires. We reported yesterday that the number of acres burned by wildfires in California is down about 90% compared to last year. That may change, but for now, it's a bright spot for that state. In Alaska, however, more than 2 million acres of forest has burned this year. And this afternoon on All Things Considered, we'll look at the impact these fires are having on the planet's atmosphere. Here and Now is a production of NPR and WBUR in association with the BBC World Service. I'm Tanya Mosley.
And I'm Peter O'Dowd. This is Here and Now.